Chapter 6. Lebedev's villa was not a large one, but was comfortable and even pretty. The part of it which was to let had been newly decorated. On the rather spacious veranda by which the house was entered from the street, orange trees, lemons and jasmines had been placed in large green wooden tubs, which, in Lebedev's opinion, gave the place a most seductive appearance. He had bought some of those trees with the villa, and was so enchanted by the effect they produced in the veranda that he resolved to take advantage of an opportunity to buy some more of the same kind at an auction. When all the shrubs had been brought to the villa and put in their places, Lebedev had several times that day run down the steps of the veranda to admire the effect from the street, and every time he mentally increased the sum which he proposed to ask from his future tenant. Mushkin, worn out, depressed, and physically shattered, was delighted with the villa. But on the day of arriving at Pavlovsk, that is, 3 days after the fit, Mushkin looked almost well again, though inwardly he still felt ill effects. He was glad to see everyone who was about him during those 3 days. He was glad of Kolya, who hardly left his side. Glad to see the Lebedev family, the nephew had gone off somewhere. He was glad to see Lebedev himself, and even welcomed with pleasure General Ivolgin, who had visited him before he left Petersburg. On the evening they arrived at Pavlovsk, a good many guests were assembled on the veranda about him. The first to arrive was Ganya, whom Mushkin hardly recognized. He had changed so much and grown so much thinner in those 6 months. Then came Varya and Titsin, who also had a villa at Pavlovsk. General Ivolgin was almost always at Lebedev's, and had apparently moved in with him. Lebedev tried to keep him in his own part of the house, and to prevent his going to see Mushkin. He treated the general like a friend. They seemed to have known each other a long time. Mushkin noticed during those 3 days that they were frequently engaged in long conversations together, that they often shouted and argued, even about learned subjects, which evidently gave Lebedev great satisfaction. One might have thought that the general was necessary to him. From the time they moved to Pavlovsk, Lebedev began to be as careful about his own family as he had been about the general. On the pretext of not disturbing Mushkin, he would not let anyone go to see him. He stamped his feet, rushed at his daughters, and chased them all away. Even Vera, with the baby, at the least suspicion that they were going onto the veranda where Mushkin was, in spite of Mushkin's begging him not to send anyone away.
"In the first place, there will be no respect shown if you let them do what they like. And in the second place, it's really improper for them," he explained at last in reply to Mushkin's direct question.
"But why so?" protested Mushkin. "Really, you only worry me with all these attentions and watchfulness. It's dull for me alone. I've told you so several times, and you depress me more than ever by the way you are always waving your hands and walking about on tiptoe."
Mushkin hinted at the fact that, though Lebedev chased away all his household on the pretext that quiet was necessary for the invalid, he had been coming in himself every minute, and always first opened the door, poked his head in, looked about the room as though he wished to make sure that he was there and had not run away, and then slowly, on tiptoe, with stealthy steps, approached the armchair, so that he sometimes startled his lodger. He was continually inquiring if he wanted anything, and when Mushkin began asking him at last to leave him alone, he turned away obediently without a word, stole on tiptoe to the door, waving his hands at every step, as though to say that he had only just looked in, that he would not say a word, that he had already gone out and would not come back. Yet within 10 minutes, or at most a quarter of an hour, he would reappear. The fact that Kolya had free access to Mushkin was a source of the deepest mortification, and even of resentful indignation to Lebedev. Kolya noticed that Lebedev used to stand at the door for half an hour at a time, listening to what he and Mushkin were talking about, and of course he informed Mushkin of the fact.
"You seem to have appropriated me, since you keep me under lock and key," Mushkin protested. "At the villa, anyway, I want it to be different. And let me tell you, I shall see anyone I like and go anywhere I choose."
"Without the faintest doubt," Lebedev protested, waving his hands.
Mushkin scanned him intently from head to foot.
"And have you brought the little cupboard here, that was hanging at the head of your bed?"
No, I haven't.
"Have you left it there?"
"It was impossible to bring it. I should have to wrench it from the wall. It's fixed firmly. Firmly.
But perhaps there's another one like it here?
A better one. A better one. It was there when I bought the villa.
Aha. Who was it you wouldn't admit to see me an hour ago?
It was the General. It's true I didn't let him in, and he ought not to come. I have a great respect for that man, Prince. He is a great man. Don't you believe me? Well, you will see. But yet, it's better, illustrious Prince, for you not to receive him.
But why so, allow me to ask? And why are you standing on tiptoe now, Lebediev? And why do you always approach me as though you wanted to whisper a secret in my ear?
Oh, I am abject. Abject, I feel it, Lebediev replied unexpectedly, striking himself on the chest with feeling. And won't the General be too hospitable for you?
Too hospitable?
Yes, hospitable. To begin with, he is intending to live with me. That he might do, but he is always in extremes. He's claiming to be a relation at once. We've been into the question of relationship several times already. It appears that we are connected by marriage. You are a second cousin of his, too, on the mother's side. He explained it to me only yesterday. If you are his cousin, then you and I must be relations too, illustrious prince. Oh, that's no matter. It's a trifling weakness. But he assured me just now that all his life, ever since he was an ensign, up to the 11th of June last year, he had never sat down to dinner with less than 200 people at his table. He went so far at last as to say they never got up from the table, so they had dinner and supper and tea for 15 hours out of 24 for 30 years on end without a break, so that they scarcely had the time to change the tablecloths. One would get up and go, and another would come, and on holidays there would be as many as 300, and on the 1000th anniversary of the foundation of Russia, he counted 700 people. It's a passion with him. Such assertions are a very bad symptom. One is quite afraid to have such hospitable people in one's house, and I've been thinking, won't a man like that be too hospitable for you and me?
But you are on excellent terms with him, I believe.
We're like brothers. Then I'd take it as a joke. Let us be connections. What does it matter? It's an honour to me. Even through the 200 people at dinner and the 1000th anniversary of Russia, I can see he's a very remarkable man. I mean it sincerely. You have spoken about secrets just now. That is, that I approach you every time as if I had a secret to tell you. And as it happens, there is a secret. A person you know of has just sent word that she would very much like to have an interview with you in secret.
Why in secret? Not at all. I'll go and see her myself today, if you like.
Not at all, not at all, Lebediev waved his hands in protest. It's not what you suppose that she is afraid of. By the way, the monster comes every day to ask after your health. Did you know it?
You really call him monster so often it makes me quite suspicious.
Well, you can feel no sort of suspicion, no sort of suspicion at all, said Lebediev, hurriedly dismissing the subject. I only wanted to explain that a certain person is not afraid of him, but of something very different, very different.
Why? Of what? Tell me quickly, Mushkin questioned impatiently, looking at Lebediev's mysterious contortions.
That's the secret,
and Lebediev laughed. Whose secret?
Your secret. You forbade me yourself to speak of it before you, most illustrious prince, Lebediev muttered.
And having thoroughly enjoyed the fact that he had excited his hearer's curiosity to painful impatience, he suddenly concluded,
"She is afraid of Aglaya Ivanovna."
Mushkin frowned and was silent for a minute.
"Oh, dear, Lebediev, I'll give up your villa," he said suddenly. "Where are the Titsins? Gavril Ardilonovich? You've enticed them away, too."
"They are coming, they are coming, and even General Ivolgin after them. I'll open all the doors, and I'll call my daughters, too. Everyone, everyone, at once, at once,"
Lebediev whispered in alarm, brandishing his arms and rushing from one door to another. At that moment, Kolya entered the veranda from the street and announced that visitors, Madame Apanchin and her three daughters, were just coming to call.
"Shall I admit the Titsins and Gavril Ardilonovich or not? "Shall I admit the general or not?" said Lebedev, skipping up, impressed by the news.
"Why not? Let anyone come who likes. I assure you, Lebedev, you've had some wrong idea about my attitude from the very beginning. You are making a mistake all the time. I have not the slightest reason for hiding and concealing myself from anyone," laughed Mushkin.
Looking at him, Lebedev felt it his duty to laugh too. In spite of his great agitation, he also seemed extremely pleased. The news brought by Kolya was true. He had come only a few steps in advance of the Epanchins to announce their arrival, so that the visitors arrived on the veranda from both sides at once, the Epanchins from the street, and the Titsins, Ganya, and General Ivolgin from indoors. The Epanchins had only just heard from Kolya that Mushkin was ill, and that he was in Pavlovsk. Till then, Madame Epanchin had been in painful perplexity. 2 days before, the general had passed on Mushkin's card to his family. The sight of that card awakened in Lizaveta Prokofievna a firm conviction that Mushkin would promptly follow it to Pavlovsk to call on them. It was in vain that her daughters assured her that a man who had not written for 6 months would perhaps be far from being in such a hurry now, and that he very likely had a great deal to do in Petersburg apart from them. How could they know what he was about? Madame Epanchin was positively angry at these remarks, and was ready to wager that Mushkin would make his appearance next day at latest, though even that would be rather late. The next day she had been expecting him all the morning. They expected him to dinner, to spend the evening, and when it got quite dark, Lizaveta Prokofievna was cross with everything, and quarrelled with everyone, making, of course, no allusion to Mushkin as the occasion of quarrel. Not one word was spoken of him on the third day, either. When at dinner Aglaya let drop the remark that Maman was angry because the prince had not come, to which her father immediately replied that it was not his fault, Lizaveta Prokofievna got up and left the table in wrath. At last, towards evening, Kolya arrived and gave them a full description of all Mushkin's adventures, so far as he knew them. Lizaveta Prokofievna was triumphant, but yet Kolya came in for a good scolding.
"He hangs about here for days together, and there's no getting rid of him. And now he might at least have let us know, if he did not think fit to come himself."
Kolya was on the point of being angry at the words, "no getting rid of him," but he put it off for another time. If the phrase had not been too offensive, he would perhaps have forgiven it altogether, for he was so pleased with Lizaveta Prokofievna's agitation and anxiety on hearing of Mushkin's illness. She insisted for a long time on the necessity of sending a special messenger to Petersburg to get hold of a medical celebrity of the first magnitude and to carry him away by the first train. But her daughters dissuaded her from this. They were unwilling, however, to be left behind by their mamma when she instantly got ready to visit the invalid.
"He is on his deathbed," said Lizaveta Prokofievna in a fluster. "And fancy our standing on ceremony. Is he a friend of the family or not?" "But we mustn't rush in before we know how the land lies,"
observed Aglaya.
"Oh, very well, then don't come. You will do well indeed. If Yevgeny Pavlovich comes, there will be no one to receive him."
At those words, Aglaya, of course, set off at once with the others, though indeed she had intended to do so before. Prince S., who had been sitting with Adelaida at her request, instantly agreed to escort the ladies. He had been much interested when he heard of Mushkin from the Epanchins before, at the very beginning of his acquaintance with them. It appeared that he was acquainted with him, that they had met somewhere lately, and had spent a fortnight together in some little town 3 months before. Prince S. had told them a great deal about Mushkin indeed, and had spoken of him in a very friendly way, so it was with genuine pleasure that he went to call on him. General Epanchin was not at home that evening. Yevgeny Pavlovich had not yet arrived, either. It was not more than 300 paces to Lebedev's villa. Lizaveta Prokofievna's first disappointment was to find quite a party of visitors with Mushkin, to say nothing of the fact that among them were two or three persons for whom she had a positive hatred. Her second disappointment was the surprise of finding a young man, to all appearance in perfect health and fashionably dressed, who came to meet them laughing, instead of the invalid whom she had expected to find on his deathbed. She actually stopped short in bewilderment, to the intense delight of Kolya, who of course might perfectly well have explained before she set out that no one was dying, and that it was not a case of a deathbed. But he had not explained it, slyly foreseeing the comic wrath of Madame Epanchin, when, as he reckoned, she would certainly be angry at finding Mushkin, for whom she had real affection, in good health. Kolya was so tactless, indeed, as to speak of his surmise aloud, so as to put the finishing touch to Lizaveta Prokofievna's irritation. He was always sparring with her, and sometimes very maliciously, in spite of their affection for one another.
"Wait a bit, my young friend. Don't be in a hurry. Don't spoil your triumph," answered Lizaveta Prokofievna, sitting down in the armchair that Mushkin set for her.
Lebediev, Titsin, and General Ivolgin flew to put chairs for the young ladies. General Ivolgin gave Aglaya a chair. Lebediev set a chair for Prince S., too, expressing profound respectfulness by the very curve of his back as he did so. Varya greeted the young ladies, as usual, in an ecstatic whisper.
"It's the truth, Prince, that I expected to find you almost in bed. I exaggerated things so in my fright, and I am not going to tell a lie about it. I felt dreadfully vexed just now at the sight of your happy face, but I swear it was only for a minute before I had time to think. I always act and speak more sensibly when I have time to think. I think it's the same with you. And yet, really, I should be less pleased, perhaps, at the recovery of my own son than I am at yours. And if you don't believe me, the shame is yours and not mine. And this spiteful boy dares to play worse jokes than this at my expense. I believe he is a protégé of yours, so I warn you that one fine morning I shall deny myself the pleasure of enjoying the honour of his further acquaintance."
"But what have I done?" cried Kolya. "However much I had assured you that the prince was almost well again, you would not have been willing to believe me, because it was much more interesting to imagine him lying on his deathbed."
"Have you come to us for long?" Lizaveta Prokofievna asked Mushkin.
"The whole summer, and perhaps longer."
"You are alone, aren't you? Not married?"
"No, not married."
Mushkin smiled at the simplicity of the taunt.
"There's nothing to smile at. It does happen. I was thinking of this villa. Why haven't you come to us? We have a whole wing empty. But do as you like."
"Have you hired it from him, that person?"
she added in an undertone, nodding at Lebediev.
"Why does he wriggle about like that?"
At that moment Vera came out of the house onto the veranda as usual with the baby in her arms. Lebediev, who was wriggling around the chairs at a complete loss what to do with himself, and desperately anxious not to go, immediately flew at Vera. He gesticulated at her, and chased her off the veranda, and, forgetting himself, even stamped with his feet.
"He's mad,"
observed Madame Epanchin suddenly.
"No, he is drunk, perhaps. Your party is not attractive," she snapped, after glancing at the other guests also. "But what a nice girl, though. Who is she?"
"That's Vera Lukianovna, the daughter of Lebediev here."
"Ah, she is very sweet. I should like to make her acquaintance."
But Lebediev, hearing Madame Epanchin's words of approval, was already dragging his daughter forward to present her.
"My motherless children," he wailed as he came up. "And this baby in her arms is motherless. Her sister, my daughter Lubov, born in most lawful wedlock from my departed wife Elena, who died 6 weeks ago in childbirth by the will of God. Yes, she takes her mother's place to the baby, though she is a sister and no more. No more, no more.
And you, sir, are no more than a fool, if you'll excuse me. That's enough. You know it yourself, I suppose,"
Lizaveta Prokofievna rapped out in extreme indignation.
"Oh, perfectly true,"
Lebediev assented with a low and respectful bow.
"Listen, Mr. Lebediev, is it true what they say? That you interpret the apocalypse?"
asked Aglaya.
"Perfectly true, for 15 years.
"I've heard about you. I think there was something in the newspapers about you."
"No, that was about another interpreter, another one. But he is dead. I've succeeded him,"
said Lebediev, beside himself with delight.
"Be so good as to interpret it to me some day soon, as we are neighbours. I don't understand anything in the apocalypse."
"I must warn you, Aglaya Ivanovna, that all this is mere charlatanism on his part, believe me,"
General Ivolgin put in quickly. He was sitting beside Aglaya, and tingling all over with eagerness to enter into conversation.
"Of course there are certain privileges on a holiday," he went on, "and certain pleasures, and to take up such an extraordinary interest for the interpretation of the apocalypse is a diversion like any other, and even a remarkably clever diversion. But I think you are looking at me with surprise. General Ivolgin, I have the honour to introduce myself. I used to carry you in my arms, Aglaya Ivanovna."
"Very glad to meet you. I know Varvara Ardalionovna and Nina Alexandrovna,"
Aglaya muttered, making desperate efforts not to burst out laughing. Lizaveta Prokofievna flushed. The irritation that had been accumulating for a long time in her heart suddenly craved for an outlet. She could not endure General Ivolgin, with whom she had been acquainted but very long ago.
"You are lying, sir, as usual. You have never carried her in your arms," she snapped out indignantly. "You've forgotten, maman. He really did, at Tavir,"
Aglaya suddenly asserted.
"We were living at Tavir then. I was 6 years old then, I remember. He made me a bow and arrow and taught me to shoot, and I killed a pigeon. Do you remember we killed a pigeon together? And you brought me a helmet made of cardboard and a wooden sword. I remember too," cried Adelaida. "I remember it too," Alexandra chimed in. "You quarrelled over the wounded pigeon. You were put in separate corners. Adelaida stood in the corner wearing the helmet and the sword."
When General Ivolgin told Aglaya that he had carried her in his arms, he said it without meaning it, merely to begin the conversation, and because he always began a conversation in that way with young people, if he wanted to make their acquaintance. But this time, as it happened, he was speaking the truth, though, as it happened, he had forgotten it. So when Aglaya declared that they had shot a pigeon together, it revived his memory of the past, and he recalled every detail himself, as elderly people often do remember something in the remote past. It is hard to say what there was in that reminiscence to produce so strong an effect on the poor general, who was, as usual, a little drunk, but he was all at once greatly moved.
"I remember! I remember it all!" he cried. "I was a captain then. It was such a pretty little mite. Nina Alexandrovna, Ganya, I used to be a guest in your house, Ivan Fyodorovich."
"And see what you've come to now," put in Madame Epanchin. "So you haven't drunk away all your better feeling. It affects you so much. But you've worried your wife to death. Instead of looking after your children, you sit in a debtor's prison. Go away, my friend. Stand in some corner behind the door and have a cry. Remember your innocence in the past, and maybe God will forgive you. Go along. Go along, I mean it. Nothing helps a man to reform like thinking of the past with regret."
But to repeat that she was speaking seriously was unnecessary. General Ivolgin, like all drunkards, was very emotional, and like all drunkards who have sunk very low, he was much upset by memories of the happy past. He got up and walked humbly to the door, so that Lizaveta Prokofievna was at once sorry for him.
"Ardalion Alexandrovich, my dear man," she called after him. "Stop a minute. We are all sinners. When you feel your conscience more at ease, come and see me. We'll sit and chat over the past. I dare say I am 50 times as great a sinner myself. But now, goodbye. Go along. It's no use your staying here," she added suddenly, afraid he was coming back. "You'd better not go after him for a while," said Mushkin, checking Kolya, who was about to run after his father. "Or he will be vexed directly, and all this minute will be spoiled for him." "That's true. Don't disturb him. Go in half an hour," Lizaveta Prokofievna decided.
"See what comes of speaking the truth for once in his life. It reduced him to tears,"
Lebedev ventured to comment.
"You are another pretty one, my man, if what I've heard is true," said Lizaveta Prokofievna, suppressing him at once.
The mutual relations of the guests about Mushkin gradually became evident. Mushkin was, of course, able to appreciate, and did appreciate to the full, the sympathy shown to him by Madame Epanchin and her daughters, and he told them with truth that before they came he had intended to have paid them a visit that day, in spite of his invalid state and the late hour. Lizaveta Prokofievna, looking at his visitors, observed that it was still possible to carry out his intention. Titsin, who was a very polite and tactful person, promptly retreated to Lebedev's quarters, and was very anxious to get Lebedev away with him. The latter promised to follow him quickly.
Varya, meanwhile, had got into talk with the girls, and remained, and she and Ganya were greatly relieved by the departure of the general. Ganya himself withdrew soon after Titsin. For the few minutes that he was in the veranda with the Apanchins, he had behaved modestly and with dignity, and was not in the least disconcerted by the determined air with which Madame Apanchin twice scanned him from head to foot. Anyone who had known him before would certainly have thought that there was a great change in him. Aglaé was very much pleased at it.
"Was that Gavril Ardialonovitch who went out?"
she asked suddenly, as she was fond of doing sometimes, interrupting the general conversation by her loud, abrupt question, and addressing no one in particular.
"Yes," answered Mushkin. "I hardly knew him. He is very much changed, and greatly for the better."
"I'm very glad," said Mushkin.
"He has been very ill,"
added Varya, in a tone of glad commiseration.
"How has he changed for the better?" Lizaveta Prokofievna asked with angry perplexity and almost in dismay. "What an idea! There's nothing better. What improvement do you see?"
"There is nothing better than the poor knight,"
Kolya, who had been standing by Madame Apanchin's chair, brought out suddenly.
"That's exactly what I think," said Prince S., and he laughed.
"I am precisely of the same opinion,"
Adelaida declared solemnly.
"What poor knight?"
asked Madame Apanchin, staring at all who had spoken with perplexity and vexation. But seeing that Aglaé flushed hotly, she added angrily,
"Some nonsense, of course. Who is this poor knight?"
"It's not the first time that urchin, your favourite, has twisted other people's words awry,"
answered Aglaé with haughty indignation. In every outburst of anger from Aglaé, and she was very often angry, there was apparent, in spite of her evident seriousness and severity, something childish and impatiently schoolgirlish, so naively disguised that it was sometimes impossible not to laugh when one looked at her, though this was the cause of extreme indignation to Aglaé, who could not understand what people were laughing at, and how they could, how they dared laugh. Her sisters and Prince S. laughed now, and even Mushkin smiled, though he too flushed at something. Kolya roared with laughter, was triumphant. Aglaé was angry in earnest and looked twice as pretty. Her confusion was very becoming to her, and so was her vexation at her own confusion.
"He has twisted so many of your words awry, too," she added.
"I based it on your own exclamation," cried Kolya. "A month ago you were looking through Don Quixote, and you cried out those very words, that there was nothing better than the poor knight. I don't know whom you are talking of, whether it was Don Quixote or Yevgeny Pavlovich or some other person. But you were talking of someone, and the conversation lasted a long while." "I see you allow yourself to go too far, young man, with your conjectures," Lizaveta Prokofievna checked him with vexation. "But am I the only one?"
Kolya persisted.
"Everybody said so, and they are saying so still. Why, Prince S. and Adelaida Ivanovna, and everyone declared just now that they stood up for the poor knight. So there must be a poor knight, and he does exist, and I believe if it were not for Adelaida Ivanovna, we should have known long ago who the poor knight was."
What have I done?"
laughed Adelaida.
"You wouldn't draw his portrait, that's what you did. Aglaé Ivanovna begged you then to draw the portrait of the poor knight, and describe the whole subject of the picture. She made the subject up herself, you remember. You wouldn't."
"But how could I draw it? According to the poem, that poor knight, no more in sight of any, raised the visor from his face. How could I draw the face, then? What was I to draw, the visor? The anonymous hero?"
"I don't understand what you mean by the visor,"
said Madame Apanchin angrily, though she was beginning to have a very clear idea who was meant by the nickname, probably agreed upon long ago, of the poor knight. But what specially angered her was that Prince Lyov Nikolaevich was also disconcerted, and at last quite abashed, like a boy of 10.
"Well, will you put a stop to this foolishness or not? Will they explain to me this poor knight? Is it such an awful secret that one can't approach it?"
But they only went on laughing.
"Well, the fact is, there is a strange Russian poem about a poor knight,"
Prince S. began at last, obviously anxious to suppress the subject and change the conversation.
"A fragment without a beginning or an end. About a month ago, we were all laughing after dinner and trying, as usual, to find a subject for Adelaida Ivanovna's next picture. You know that the whole family is always trying to find subjects for Adelaida Ivanovna's pictures. Then we hit on the poor knight. Which of us first, I don't remember. Aglaya Ivanovna, cried Kolya. Well, perhaps, I dare say, only I don't remember, Prince S. went on. Some of us laughed at the subject, others declared that nothing could be better, but that to paint the poor knight, we must find a face for him. We began to go over the faces of all our friends. Not one was suitable, and there we left it. That was all. I don't know why Nikolay Ardilonovich thought fit to recall it all and bring it up again. What was amusing and appropriate at the time is quite uninteresting now. Because some fresh foolishness is meant mischievous and offensive, Lizaveta Prokofievna snapped out.
There's no foolishness in it. Nothing but the deepest respect, Aglaya suddenly brought out, quite unexpectedly, in a grave and earnest voice.
She had mastered her confusion by now, and completely recovered from it. What's more, one might, looking at her, have supposed from certain signs that she was positively glad that the jest was going so far, and this revulsion of feeling took place in her at the very moment when Mushkin's increasing and overwhelming embarrassment had become unmistakably evident to everyone.
That one time they are laughing like mad things, and then they talk of the deepest respect. Crazy creatures! Why respect? Tell me at once, what makes you drag in deepest respect when it's neither here nor there?
Deepest respect,
Aglaya went on as gravely and earnestly in response to her mother's almost spiteful questions.
Because that poem simply describes a man who is capable of an ideal. And what's more, a man who, having once set an ideal before him, has faith in it, and having faith in it, gives up his life blindly to it. This does not always happen in our day. We are not told, in that poem, exactly what the poor knight's ideal was, but one can see it was some vision, some image of pure beauty, and the knight in his loving devotion has put a rosary round his neck instead of a scarf. It's true that there is some obscure device, of which we are not told in full, the letters A-N-B inscribed on his shield.
A-M-D, Kolya corrected her.
But I say A-N-B, and that's what I want to say.
Aglaya interrupted with vexation.
Anyway, it's clear that that poor knight did not care what his lady was or what she did. It was enough for him that he had chosen her and put faith in her pure beauty, and then did homage to her forever. That's just his merit, that if she became a thief afterwards, he would still be bound to believe in her and be ready to break a spear for her pure beauty. The poet seems to have meant to unite in one striking figure the grand conception of the platonic love of medieval chivalry, as it was felt by a pure and lofty knight. Of course, all that's an ideal. In the poor knight, that feeling reaches its utmost limit in asceticism. It must be admitted that to be capable of such a feeling means a great deal, and that such feelings leave behind a profound impression. Very, from one point of view, laudable, as with Don Quixote, for instance. The poor knight is the same Don Quixote, only serious and not comic. I didn't understand him at first, and laughed. But now I love the poor knight, and once more respect his exploits.
This was how Aglaya concluded. And looking at her, it was difficult to tell whether she was in earnest or laughing.
Well, he must have been a fool anyway, he and his exploits, was her mother's comment. And you are talking nonsense, my girl, a regular tirade. It's not quite nice of you, to my thinking. In any case, it's not good manners. What poem? Read it. No doubt you know it. I must hear it. I've always disliked poetry. I knew no good would come of it. For goodness sake, put up with it, Prince. You and I have got to put up with things together, it seems, she added, addressing Mushkin.
She was very much annoyed. Mushkin tried to say something, but was still too embarrassed to speak. But Aglaya, who had taken such liberties in her tirade, was not in the least confused, but seemed pleased indeed. She got up at once, still grave and earnest as before, looking as though she had prepared herself, and was only waiting to be asked. Stepped into the middle of the veranda, and stood facing Mushkin, who was still sitting in his armchair. Everyone stared at her with some surprise, and almost all of them, Prince S., her sisters, and her mother, looked with an uncomfortable feeling at this new prank, which had already gone too far. But it was evident that what delighted Aglaya was just the affectation with which she was beginning the ceremony of reading. Her mother was on the point of sending her back to her seat, but at the very instant when Aglaia began to recite the well-known ballad, two more visitors entered the veranda from the street, talking loudly. These visitors were General Epanchin and a young man who followed him. Their entrance caused a slight commotion.